Aloha and welcome to the conversation on this very wet Wednesday. It's the 1st of March and boy, did it come in with a storm. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich and to my right, as always, Chris Vandekook.
Good morning. Beth. Hello. Looking at you through the blinding rain we saw this morning.
And for people who spent 2 and 3 hours, in some cases, just trying to get to where they needed to go because of it. Well, if you're still out there in it now and with us, well, we're very glad for your company. Hawaii coffee growers have worked hard to develop their share of the specialty coffee market. Their effort has been undermined, though, by the coffee berry borer. It was first discovered in Kona in 2010. A few years later, the state responded by lowering quality standards for the farmers and also for the growers on Maui, although the pest had yet to show up there until this past January. The coffee farms on each island have different geographical situations, though, and it's why the head of the Maui Coffee Association is chagrined those differences weren't taken into account when the state decided to continue the lower standards. Sydney Smith is the head of the Maui Coffee Association. We talked about why Maui coffee is still being devalued and how association members are responding.
The Quality Assurance Division of the Hawaii Department of Agriculture 3 years ago, lowered the quality standards in an effort to assist the Kona coffee farmers who are affected by the coffee berry borer. It had a 3-year sunset. We were against the original lowering of standards, but now they want to extend it for 3 more years, which would be a total of 6 years of lowered standards. I think it's ironic that the Quality Assurance Division of the Department of Agriculture is lowering the quality. And we have gone on record of being against it from day one. And so the very name of their division, Quality Assurance, to me makes it their mandate to assure that there's quality, not to undermine the quality. That's my real argument with them. And I understand that they're basically between a rock and a hard place. They have all these farmers that are saying they're going to go out of business if they don't do something. They want to support agriculture. But on the other hand, their very mandate is to protect the consumer. So I understand that they're in a bad situation, but sometimes you have to take a hard line. And I think that more farms would have been diligent in controlling the coffee berry borer if they knew there was a real monetary penalty for not doing it. And there is subsidy programs for the treatment of the coffee berry borer so that there's not a lot of, you know, real expense if they qualify for the help. And I think they've been very forthcoming and helpful.
Sydney, knowing that at some point the coffee berry borer will make its way to coffee farms is like having a Damocles over your head, which would also seem to suggest that at that point you would have to perhaps, you know, devalue the quality issue again. Does it make sense to have it sunset now and then have to maybe bring it back within the next 3-year period?
I can't see that any of the farmers in Maui would ever request a lowering of quality standards. It just means that there's going to have to be more diligence on the part of the farmer to select the best beans and to very, you know, vigilantly look after their farms so that we don't allow the damage to get established and to get the coffee berry borer, you know, places to roam around and breed indiscriminately, which is, you know, what happened in the Kona area. There's a lot of abandoned farms that are right next to active farms. We don't really have that here in Maui County, so it won't be quite as much of an issue. But again, this is looking into the future. We don't really know what it will bring, but I can't imagine any of our farmers asking the Department of Agriculture to lower the quality standards. It's just not the philosophy that we have here.
No, not coming from necessarily the growers themselves, but the state looking at it in some way to create parity with what is happening on the Big Island if, in fact, the coffee berry borer gets a foothold in your farms. But you make a point that because the structure is different, you don't have abandoned coffee farms next to active ones and you have the ability to be more vigilant. Your point seems to be, well, you know, as long as things are good, let them be good and don't devalue us.
Yeah, we want to keep our prices high, and we don't want to have to spend a lot of time telling the consumer that, you know, our coffee quality is excellent, and we currently have a good reputation. But I think it undermines that when the Department of Agriculture, you know, just lowers the quality standards. There's a situation in Jamaica where most people have heard of Jamaica Blue Mountain Coffee, and the country decided to quit certifying coffee. And so anyone can take any coffee from anywhere and put it in a barrel. They actually sell their coffee in wood barrels and sell it as Jamaica Blue Mountain. So now the reputation of that coffee is gone. No one buys it. It was the most expensive coffee that you could buy. And now no one wants to buy it because they're not sure what they're going to get. I don't want to see that happen here. This is going to be 6 years when this sunsets, and they do assure me that it will never be extended. But that's what they said last time, that it was only going to be for 3 years, and now we're looking at another three.
And in the state, we have a very real issue with what the word temporary means.
Yes.
So from your perspective now, is there anything you think that you can tell the state or that they would be open to hearing so that you don't have this three-year extension? Or is this just simply a fait accompli?
Well, I believe it's a fait accompli. I did testify last week, giving them exactly what I've said here today, that I represent the Coffee Association, the coffee farmers on Maui, and we're all against it. But I felt from the conversation that it was already decided.
So what do you do now in this next three-year period to be able to safeguard your reputation and to be able to also feel that you know, you're not going to have to do a lot of backpedaling if, in fact, the coffee bore comes in and you are seeing it in certain select places but not throughout all the farms? How do you safeguard yourselves at all?
We have to do a lot of outreach to the public to let them know how diligent we are. And it's a little extra work for us. It's worth it, though. And we have great support from our county, from the office, the Mayor's Office of Economic Development. They've been very supportive in helping us to do outreach to the community. We'll have the statewide conference in July, this coming July, for the entire state, and it'll be here in Maui. And so we'll have an opportunity then to, you know, really focus on quality and, you know, how much we're working to maintain the perception of quality and the reality of quality in Maui coffee.
And a great opportunity to showcase it while everyone is there. Thank you so much for giving us some time this morning, and we wish you all the best.
Thank you.
Sydney Smith is the owner of Malika Estate Coffee. Maliko, I should say, Estate Coffee, a 20-acre coffee farm near Makawao. She's president of the Maui Coffee Association and a member of the Ag Working Group. That's an advisory group for agricultural matters for the Maui County Council and Administration.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, a celebration of the charming scoundrel. But first, your quiz. In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about an invasive species of plant that once grew unchecked in the Hawaiian Islands. It's a very hardy plant, a segmented cactus that typically reaches heights of 3 to 5 meters with a lateral span of 2 to 3 times its height at maturity.
Its Latin name is Opuntia ficus indica and was probably introduced into Hawaii from Mexico by Don Francisco de Paula Marin in about 1809. It was intended to meet several needs, as fodder for cattle, as a barrier between cattle pastures, and as a food source for people. As with so many invasives, it thrived in the Hawaii climate and soon overran the pastures it was supposed to protect, crowding cattle out of their grazing lands. It was eventually brought under control by the introduction of a biological control agent, the tunneling larval caterpillar of the cactus moth, a species native to Argentina. Its name in Hawaiian means barrier, and this morning we're looking for both the Hawaiian and English names. If you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And if you get it right in your first, well, you'll get the prize.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Matson, completing the 15th year of their Kaipu Aina program, partnering with charities that clean litter from our islands, shores, and parks. Learn more at matson.com/foundation.
You can't cheat an honest man, as the saying goes, and con artists know that all of us have a little larceny in our soul. Because of that, we have a kind of grudging admiration for the clever con artist, the kind of smooth operator who knows his victims want to believe his story. The theater musical Dirty Rotten Scoundrels plays on our inner need to go along with the con. Lisa Teichner is directing the Maui On Stage production that opens this weekend, and she says it's important that we like the show's con artists, no matter how dastardly they might be.
That is critical, and fortunately that's not a very difficult job because I have two great actors in the role, and they're very likable people, and that it comes through even when they're sleazy in the show. You definitely care about them, and you're interested in their story. But yeah, that is a challenge. That is a challenge in general to make the bad guys likable.
It's a kind of sleaziness that the audience has a certain amount of complicity in, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and you do see a journey as well. It's not that they remain the same. Like any good show, there is an arc for those characters, and they change and they grow and they learn. And I won't give away the ending, but you know, there is definitely a journey there.
There kind of has to be for just about any story to work, don't you think?
Yeah, it's the components of drama in general, and drama being the basis for anything, including, you know, comedy. That it's all the foundation is having a plot and a character, you know, and the story, and it's good. I mean, it's well written. It was a great film, and a lot of that transfers to the stage production. It's a very interesting kind of interpretation in terms of I've seen other shows or worked on other shows where there's been a film and then it translates to the stage, mm-hmm. and you find different challenges as opposed to when you have a stage that goes into a film, because in film you can switch immediately to, you can just cut to another location. So
yeah.
That tends to be a challenge, is that you have multiple locations, so you have to be really creative about how you tell the story and, you know, where people are and how they travel from one place to another. So, yeah, it's been interesting. It's been fun. We have great designers, so that really helps. And it's a collaborative effort, but it's a really good group of people, and people are going to be incredibly entertained. It's very funny. Even if you have not seen the movie, you don't have to have seen the movie.
Yeah.
For
Lisa,
it to let's stand on its own, but it does help because it just adds another level of that humor and nostalgia.
Let's kind of set the stage. We're on the French Riviera, playground of the idle rich, and there are some wealthy women around and some opportunistic males.
Correct.
Where do we go from there?
So yes, it's Beaumont-sur-Mer in French Riviera, as you mentioned, and there is kind of a playboy, a little bit of an older playboy, an experienced con artist who is working that's his territory right now, and he owns that territory,
mm-hmm.
and he does prey on wealthy, you know, women who have inherited money usually come by their money pretty easily and will not, it's not going to devastate them or change their entire life for him to successfully con them out of jewelry. And they willingly give him, you know, I mean, the story that he tells is obviously untrue, but they willingly participate in this fantasy and story. So he does prey on them. He has the chief of police there who is on his side, who helps him find information, kind of functions as a detective and gets information on who the best, you know, targets will be. And so we see this happen at the beginning. And then another very kind of juvenile con artist comes into this territory, and they meet each other, which is an interesting meeting. And the young con artist sees the brilliance of this more experienced con artist and wants to learn from him, and kind of forces him into his area and convinces him to take him under his wing and show him the ropes.
The older and the younger con artists have very different methods, right?
Oh, yes, very different. Yeah, the older con artist, he's learned. I mean, I don't know what he was like, you know, 20 years ago when he started this business, but he's very refined. He's, you know, he's suave. He's got it down. He understands the art of the con.
Yeah.
And the younger one is incredibly rough around the edges, comes from an environment that wasn't very forgiving or nurturing for him. So he's rough. He's a rough guy. He's the complete opposite of suave. It makes for definitely some humor, and you see their various approaches to how they want to get what they want.
Lisa, one of the things that happens with the con is that you don't know where it stops, right? You don't know who's conning whom, even to the point of conning yourself.
True, and that's what you want. I mean, a successful con, those lines get blurred, and you do start to question. And as an audience member, when you watch too, at least when it comes to Lawrence, the older character, again, he's very good at that. So you're picking up all the nuances. You're trying to understand what he's doing. Freddie character, you know, he's pretty obvious in that. And sometimes you say, well, you know, how could anybody fall for that or believe what he's doing? And he doesn't seem very successful at it. But yeah, it's you get mixed up. I mean, this show, the way it's written, it's very well written, and there are twists and turns in the plot that are, you know, potentially unexpected, which makes it interesting, and it keeps your focus.
You know, Lisa, you talked about the how you have to some degree be complicit in the con. You know, that the older guy's victims, to some degree, know that they're being victimized.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, that's a parallel with the audience in a show like this, right? You have to sort of willingly give in to being conned a little bit by the show itself.
Absolutely. Yes, you want to you want to come to this saying, great, take me on this journey with you and let me really kind of surrender myself to this and get carried away in the story. Absolutely. I think that's a great way to say it. As an audience member, you will enjoy it the most with that, you know, coming to it with that kind of attitude and philosophy. And
well, theater's
swept up in what these women are doing.
Theater is a deception, right? It's not really the French Riviera.
Yes, suspension of disbelief in location. You're doing that already, so absolutely. It's great fun. And there's some wonderful two new cast members. I love when we do shows with people that have never been seen on Maui. There's a lot of seasoned pros. Leah Craig is in it, and a lot of people in the Maui theater community know her, and Stephen Desculius. And then we have some newcomers, Ross Young and Bennett Kale, who have never been seen in a show on Maui before, and they're fantastic. So that's really a fun thing to see some new people. And our ensemble are fantastic singers and dancers.
Lisa Teichner is the director of the Maui On Stage production of Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, which opens Friday and runs until March 19th at the Iao Theater in Wailuku. You can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Aloha, I'm Aiden James from Honolulu. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
I'm
near the McDonald's on Kohio. There was about 5 gunshot fires.
The guy that got shot, is he moving?
He's not moving at all.
A law enforcement killing in 2011, a murder in 1932. What do they have in common? I'll give you a hint. It's not just race, and it's not just power. Offshore, a new series from Honolulu Civil Beat, starting on HPR March 11th.
The near death of a toddler at an Eva Beach daycare stunned parents and lawmakers with a less-than-best-practice investigation. It also brought up a basic question. Why weren't the other daycare parents told about the apparent abuse? John Hill is a reporter with Civil Beat. He broke the story, and he joins us now with a reality check update. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
This case has just galvanized attention of so many parts of our community, from law enforcement to certainly lawmakers at the legislature, parents at the daycare, people in general. This seems to be moving in a direction where a lot of people who have been looking at daycare centers for a very long time have wanted it to go, where there is more reporting, where there is a lot of knowledge, but just something as basic as why weren't the other parents told? Have you gotten an answer to that one?
Not really a clear answer to that. There was a panel shortly after the toddler was injured at the daycare, a panel of child abuse experts who reviewed the case, who recommended that Honolulu Police Department get in touch with the other parents, and that never happened.
Which goes back to the idea that this was not done in any way to conform with best practices. Some of these parents have said that they found out about it because of your story. Is that true?
That's correct. There was a lot of talk on social media about our story, and one parent told me he saw it there. Another parent, I think, read the story that we did. So that's how they found out, and they were really surprised. They had their kids there for months, at least months, after the incident, and didn't know one thing about it.
The story of what had happened to little Peyton Valiente and how by likely by abuse, he wound up in the hospital. Since that time, have the parents been talking to each other and to you about what they've noticed? Has there been anything that's come out that hasn't been within the parameters of an investigation?
In terms of their own children being injured?
Or have you seen something or anything more to this case than what we've been told up to now through whatever investigation there was?
I mean, there's nothing clear-cut in terms of what happened to their own children. One thing that's interesting is that the experts in child abuse investigations say it's oftentimes worthwhile to interview even very young children about what they saw. So these children who were also at the daycare that day when Peyton was injured were never spoken to, and some of them are old enough to be verbal.
So what's happening now with the full review of this incident that was ordered by Acting Chief or HPD Chief Kari Okimoto?
We're going to find out more today at 2 p.m. There's a police commission meeting. It's on the agenda. There's going to be an update. I'm not sure if this is going to be kind of a final conclusion or just a sort of an interim update, but we'll probably learn more. I know they are looking at their procedures for handling child abuse cases, and they're also looking at individual cases from the past 3 years or so. So it'll be interesting to hear what they say today.
Well, thanks very much for joining us for a reality check, and good on you for the story.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
John Hill is a reporter with Civil Beat. He broke the story of the near death of toddler Peyton Valiente at an Eva Beach daycare.
Support for today's programming comes from Maui Arts and Cultural Center. Sean Dorsey Dance performs The Missing Generation, an homage to early AIDS epidemic survivors. 7:30 p.m. tomorrow at Castle Theater. MauiArts.com. www.hawaiipublicradio.org.
Generations of American leaders have tried to shepherd the Palestinian-Israeli peace process since the 1970s. There have been more successful moments, others far less so. But how much of the current situation rests with the Palestinian leadership itself? Bassam Eid is a journalist and the founder and former director of the Jerusalem-based Palestinian Human Rights Monitoring Group. He's in Honolulu to speak tomorrow night at Temple Emmanuel about the state of Palestinian politics and the prospects for peace. And Bassam Eid joins us now in our studio. Good morning. Thank you for being here.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me.
It has often seemed that Palestinians have been the pawns of leadership, not always the beneficiaries of it. How do you assess Palestinian leadership now, and do you agree with the basic supposition that they have been pawns?
Unfortunately, that's exactly what I used to tell my colleague Palestinians all the time. That looks like to me that the most tragic thing in the life of Palestinians is their own leadership. I think that since 1947 until today, the Palestinians almost kept as hostages for their own leadership and for the Arab leadership. Since 1947 until today, what the Palestinian leadership and what the Arabs' leadership did to the Palestinians? In my opinion, with the current Palestinian existing leadership, looks like that we, the Palestinians, at least need at least two more generations. Probably after two more generations, a charismatic, courageous, a serious leader will be born, and then probably will be able to solve the so-called Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Throughout the past decades, we've had people who have sort of surfaced in that with that characteristic about being charismatic and being able to make certain points. I'm thinking about of Anwar Sadat in the late 80s and early 90s, and some of what we saw come out of Camp David, that there were some points, bright spots. But in general, it always has slipped back. And although there seems to still be some reliance on the roadmap to peace, it seems like it's been hitting barrier after barrier after barrier. As you look now at the current state of American leadership, this president, as well as the current state of Israeli leadership under Benjamin Netanyahu, do you see that there is a place for real movement in that, or just, as you say, we're going to have to wait for two generations for any serious movement?
I am not quite sure that with the new American administration I can see any optimistic points towards any kind of solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Unfortunately, in the past, let's say 20 years, with the all previous American administrations, in my opinion, those administrations almost failed to find out any kind of solution between the Israelis and the Palestinians. I heard Mr. Trump last year in March, during his participation in the AIPAC conference, when he stood up and said that I am the only one who can solve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But when people start laughing, then he continues saying, as a businessman, not as a politician. Sometimes I am looking to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as a kind of a business rather than it is a political conflict. And looks like if there are a real serious businessman around the world, probably I think that these people should have to replace the old politicians which almost failed to solve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, because I'm a person who believes that while improving the economy of the Palestinians and the Israelis, probably that's the only method which might pave the way towards a kind of solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
That idea of creating a Middle East community that's interdependent on itself economically, has been around for a while. I'm thinking about some of the conversation that we've had with those at Transcend that have been talking about this for years and years and years, too. But being able to see the interdependence as being more important than the acrimony seems to be where this is now. How do you get people to understand that there is an importance in being interdependent as a Middle Eastern community?
See, I'm much more try to getting a such kind of thing, by the way, from the Palestinians themselves. Today, if you will come to any ordinary Palestinian and asking him what are the most three priorities that you are seeking, he will say a job to survive, to secure the education system and the health system for my children. Which means, in my opinion, that the majority of the Palestinians are people who are seeking dignity rather than identity. I used to teach my Palestinian colleagues all the time that homeland is not the place where you're born. Homeland is the place where you can get dignity, justice, and freedoms. And I think that the Palestinians more and more start realizing right now that the economic situation is much more important than the political one.
Because it allows for them to have the kind of quality life that you just described a moment ago.
I think that people trying more and more to improve their own daily life, to improve their economic situation, and probably this is one of the main reasons why the Palestinians right now are not really so aware about any kind of independence.
We've talked to Palestinian filmmakers, artists who say, look, in my community, we have Palestinians living next to and Arabs living next to those who are Jews, and we want our kids to be able to grow up and live in peace, and we're concerned about their future as much as our own, and we don't necessarily feel that our governments represent us very well. And that it's operating on two different levels, what's happening governmentally and what's happening at the community level, the neighborhood level. How comfortable are you with what's happening with the Israeli government and how Benjamin Netanyahu is responding to some of the concerns that you've been voicing and being able to work with a Palestinian splintered government in a way that would be meaningful?
First of all, I think that the Israeli government right now probably much more aware about the economic situation of the Palestinians rather than the Palestinian Authority itself. On the other side, I think that today the majority of the Palestinians can say it very clearly and loudly that they have no problem to continue living under the Israeli sovereignty under one condition. If Israel will give them an equal rights like any other Jewish guy in living inside Israel. I think that the people are seeking a kind of a equality here. I think that the people almost became so frustrated and so hopeless from their own leadership, which means that people are ready to do today anything which probably can bring them any kind of equality, even under the Israeli sovereignty.
Which sounds like more of a one-state solution than a two.
See, I think that more and more voices from Palestinians right now coming out calling for the one-state solution, because looks like that the Palestinians never ever believe that the Palestinian Authority or the current Palestinian Authority will bring them a state in any time in the future.
How do you get their perspectives out when what we mostly hear is from the Palestinian leadership in whatever form it may be at whatever time?
This is one of the major problems, unfortunately, that the media all the time depends its reports on what the Palestinian leadership is talking about, what the Palestinian leadership is announcing, what the Palestinian leadership is stating. But unfortunately, I didn't see any journalists today who are getting inside the Palestinian neighborhoods, inside the Palestinian refugee camps, and asking the Palestinians directly what they are suffering from and what is really paining them. In my opinion, the media today trying more and more to forget, let's say, the ordinary Palestinians, and unfortunately the media trying more and more to focus today what the Palestinian leadership are talking about, which is far away from the perspective of the ordinary Palestinians.
I wish we had much more time to talk, but I thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Founder and former director of the Jerusalem-based Palestinian Human Rights Monitoring Group, Bassam Eid, grew up in a United Nations refugee camp. He describes himself as a proud Palestinian who wants peace and prosperity for his people. And he's going to be sharing his insights on improving the prospects for peace and the state of Palestinian politics tomorrow night at Temple Emmanuel at 7 o'clock.
Aloha, this is Alan Oshima. You're tuned to Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Twitter. Talk back to your radio at HI Conversation.
In today's Backyard Quiz, the history of Hawaii is filled with stories of species introductions that proved to be disastrous, and this is one of them. Ironically, this plant's runaway spread was brought under control by another species introduction, a highly successful one. It's a cactus that was intended to act as a wall between cattle pastures and as a food source for cattle. Introduced in the early 19th century, it ended up spreading out of control, choking off pasture lands, particularly on Maui and Hawaii Island. It was brought under control by a biological control agent that had first been used in Australia. That agent was the tunneling larval caterpillar of the cactus moth, a species native to Argentina. The larvae burrow into the cactus and devour it from the inside out, leaving nothing above ground. Today, the cactus can still be found in isolated clusters around the islands, but is no longer the environmental threat it once was. It's known in Hawaiian as the panini cactus, in English as the prickly pear.
And Una Greenaway called us from Kona, knew the answer, and will be receiving a prize just to prove that fact. If you have a question for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, and you just might hear it on a future show.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000's Home Edition, an online tool designed for parents to strengthen the school-home connection by creating continuity between classwork and homework. Achieve3000.com.
Rachel Davies is a Maui-based hypnotherapist who was introduced to her craft when, as a child learning from books, she learned to hypnotize herself. That experience made her a believer, and she's offering a workshop in how hypnotherapy can help us learn to sleep better. She's offering a Sweet Dreams sleep workshop tomorrow. She's on the line to tell us how it works. Good morning, Rachel.
Good morning, Chris. Thanks for having me on the show.
My pleasure. I'm fascinated by the idea that you started out by hypnotizing yourself.
Yeah, I was a kid, and I think my mom gave me a book where a character hypnotized somebody else, and I became fascinated, and I would sort of sit in rooms, you know, staring at dots on the wall and try to work out how to get myself into that really relaxed place where all that magic happens.
Well, it seems to have worked, right?
Yeah, it does. I've been using hypnosis for, at least a couple of decades actively, and especially to go to sleep. I find it really helps me if I feel anxious, or sometimes I just have time for a short nap, a little 20-minute nap, and I'll use some guided imagery, and I'll just have such a deep, nourishing rest, and I'll bounce back up. So really love using hypnotherapy for my life.
What's guided imagery?
Guided imagery is really another word for hypnotherapy. It's, you listen to a recording and someone will say, just noticing how comfortable you might like to feel, getting yourself begin to relax. And, yeah, it's just another word for what hypnotherapists do. And sometimes when I see a client, I'll record the session and they'll listen to it at home later, and that would be called guided imagery too.
Well, Rachel, give me an idea of what the hypnotherapist does.
What we do is, in your life it's easy just to be up in your conscious mind. And, well, for me, I'm running around and I've got to pay my bill and I've got to go to work. So there's all that. But underneath there's a big reservoir of kind of deep knowledge. Like, you could say, what does my future self think of this? Or what is my higher self? Mm-hmm. I think my higher self would know the answer to this problem. So when we do hypnotherapy, we just drop down underneath that conscious mind and open the doors to, like, our deepest wisdom and intelligence. And then from that place, we bring solutions, So you could put a problem in there, or you could think, I work with a client who's having trouble getting to sleep. She'd wake up and she'd feel anxious. So we drop down into that quiet place under the conscious mind, and then she remembered all the really good sleeps that she'd ever had, and we found a way of weaving those in. So if she ever felt anxious before she went to sleep, we connected that down to all the really good sleeps that she'd have. So rather than going into anxiety, she'd drop into, remembering all those good sleep experiences. And she found that she slept so deeply after that every time. So I don't know if I made it any clearer, Chris.
Well, I'm working on it, Whenever I mention hypnosis or hypnotherapy to people, I almost always get the same response. Well, you couldn't hypnotize me.
Yeah.
A lot of people think that, right?
Yeah, everybody thinks that. Because hypnosis is, in the movies and stuff, people get people to bark like, a dog.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's a sort of way of tricking somebody, but
yeah.
I think it's not really true that you can do that, or stage hypnotists do that in it's really a theatrical performance.
But can induce a kind of relaxation, is what you're saying.
Exactly. Like, if you read a really good book or you watch a really good movie and you find yourself completely absorbed in a world,
mm-hmm.
It's exactly the same as hypnotherapy, being hypnotized. You just get engrossed or absorbed in something.
But, that's a pretty rare experience, right? Out of, you see 20 movies and you might not ever feel that way.
Yeah, that's true, Chris. That's my job, is to have the skill to help a person reach that level of absorption, in a session. So to help them, often it's a classic thing just to focus on the breath and put your attention there and slowly become absorbed into your body's experience. But there's lots of ways to do it and just sort of go into that place of just being really relaxed and absorbed.
Well, Rachel,
my partner, Patty Stabler, that we're doing the sleep workshop with, she's a person that says that she could never be hypnotized. She's spent years trying to be hypnotized, and we did a session the other day together. She has migraine headaches, and I could hypnotize her, and she didn't realize in the session. She was like, I'm not sure if I was hypnotized. I was just very relaxed. I felt very good. But when she listened to the recording later, there was all these things that I said that she couldn't remember at all, and she realized that actually she'd gone into a really deep state of relaxation and hypnosis.
And this is somebody who was resistant.
Oh, so resistant. She was absolutely sure that she couldn't be hypnotized, and she tried many different times with other people.
But you seem to have had this happen often, a resistant client.
Yes. Just because people, there's such a, there's so much of a stigma about hypnotherapy with the, that sort of pluck like a chicken thing. So often people are quite closed at the beginning. But once they experience it, they realize what a
sort of natural and fun and really powerful thing it is, and then they tend to really look forward to it.
Do you think acceptance of hypnotherapy is growing?
Yeah, it is. My teacher, Rochelle Jaffe, she teaches in the Ashland School, and she was doing a lot of work in the UK and Europe this year, and she said that it was just totally normal. People were like, of course, you know, using mindfulness and hypnotherapy is really powerful. And it was a huge, it was a very developed field there. And she said that she also notices with her clients in Oregon that there's more and more acceptance of it as a really powerful kind of therapy.
So that's, I mean, since obviously it's, you know, non-invasive, drug-free therapy, it really kind of opens up some possibilities, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. You know, like, I listen to a sleep meditation to go to sleep, and it, my mother's currently got cancer, and she's really sort of very anxious, and I gave her a sleep meditation, and she listens to it every night, and she said that she wakes up, she feels full of energy, she doesn't worry so much, she doesn't wake up in the night worrying, and just that simple thing of having something to help you go to sleep can make such a profound difference in a person's life, because they just have more resources and more energy in the day for all the things that they need to do.
Sounds pretty hopeful, Rachel. Thanks very much for talking with us. Rachel Davies of Wild Intelligence Hypnotherapy will present a Sweet Dreams Sleep Workshop at the Maui Research and Technology Center tomorrow at 12:15 p.m., and you can learn more about it on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
There are always a lot of different activities going on throughout the state, and Morning Edition host and our colleague, Derek Malama, joins us at this time each day for a look at events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar. Derek, what's cooking today?
Well, Chris, tomorrow, the Women of Wonders Film Festival celebrates the accomplishments of women here in Hawaii and around the world, and it concludes in the Doris Duke Theater tomorrow, and it's free. For a scheduled visit, HawaiiWomenInFilmmaking.org. Tomorrow's program starts at 6 and features three films produced by local directors, and it ends with a documentary that was filmed in East L.A.,
called Ovarian Psycho?
Yes, yes. That I'd let you say the title of that, but yeah.
I'm speechless. But it's pretty intriguing, isn't it?
Yeah, it makes me want to go see it. Tomorrow, you can hear music focusing on John Coltrane at St. Peter's Episcopal Church on Queen Emma Street. It's Jazz Vespers, A Love Supreme at 6, featuring, I know you know all these people that I'm going to mention,
yes,
right?
Yes, I do.
Okay, it's Reggie Padilla on sax, Star Kalahiki vocals, Dan Del Negro piano, and John Hawes on bass. A jazz in a contemplative style. Now, what exactly does that mean?
Well, A Love Supreme, Derek, is really one of the greatest works of jazz history. It's the saxophonist John Coltrane. It's his spiritual testament. It's about a 40-minute album-length piece, and incredibly powerful and moving sort of use of jazz to tell a story.
Oh, I see.
So this would be spectacular. It really will.
Yeah. They'll have improvisations on the first movement tomorrow, and next week on the 9th, they'll also be doing that. So, yeah, as you said, all of this is in a contemplative style, and it is rarely heard live.
All too rarely, yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have, of course, Hawaii's Hot Club of Hulaville, but they're reflective of a worldwide phenomenon, the whole the inspiration of the late Django Reinhardt.
I did not know that until I looked into this here. You can dance the night away on the Big Island or just enjoy the music of the Hot Club of San Francisco, featuring French vocalist Isabel Fontaine. The UH Hilo Performing Arts Center's annual fundraiser includes donated hors d'oeuvres, that would be French poo-poos, and beverages. This evening invokes an unforgettable Parisian experience while supporting the arts and education in East Hawaii. Once again, that's 7 p.m. at the UH Hilo Performing Arts Center.
Wear your beret.
I would if I could.
Me too.
If I had one.
Yeah, me too. Time to remedy that. Thanks very much, Derek.
Oh, you're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that are under the radar, and you can always find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Beth Ann, some really interesting and provocative ideas about the whole Palestinian issue.
When we talked a little earlier with Bassem Eid, yes, I mean, to hear what he's had to say, which he's been saying for about 28 years or so, so he's not living in fear of any sort of, you know, reprisals or death threats. But looking at what is leadership going to do? What's the Palestinian leadership really going to do to be able to move this, you know, forward? We've had little points, as you know, in, you know, from the late 70s into the 80s and early 90s, where there were these glimmers of hope. Everything has, you know, fallen short in recent years, though.
You kind of see the pendulum effect of history, you know, the glimmer of hope followed by discouragement, followed by renewed hope.
And you heard what he had to say about needing maybe two more generations before we're going to be able to see any real substantive movement. A lot of people hearing that and feeling quite, I think, discouraged by
that. That's a pretty discouraging thought, I have to say.
Well, that's going to do it for us for this Wednesday. Now, we're almost at the halfway point of this legislative session. We're going to take a look tomorrow during Town Square on how the energy agenda is doing. Jeff Michelina of Blue Planet Foundation will be here. So will HECO Scott Sue.
And tell us, as a listener, what you think about Maui's coffee quality standards, hypnotherapy, or any of the things you heard talked about on today's program or any of our shows. Call our talkback line at 808-792-8217 and leave us your comments. Twitter is HI Conversation.
And HPR has a new mobile app that makes it so easy to live stream the conversation and every other HPR program. You can listen to past shows, take care of anything you like. Just find the app on the App Store or at Google Play.
I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you tomorrow for more of the conversation.